This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this afternoon, TSN1290.ca. Good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you. Late start Saturday afternoon with the Jets and the Ducks. Game 2 going at 9:30 this evening. Game you can hear live on this fine station. Alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel, and we welcome you to the program. Gentlemen, Game 1, Thursday night, in the rearview mirror now. A little bit of a disappointing result, a disappointing third period for the Winnipeg Jets as they entered the period with the 2-1 lead. I think, you know, the Jets, not a function of overconfidence so much in Game 1, but a function in maybe the Jets, the public, the pundits, everybody underestimating just how good Ryan Getzlaf and Corey Perry can be when they need to be.
Yeah, guys, it was a disappointing result for the Jets in Game 1. Drew, I can say right off the bat, I never underestimated how good Ryan Getzlaf and Corey Perry could be. When we were previewing this series, we said that this series was even, as most series this year are, Richie, and we knew that Ryan Getzlaf and Corey Perry, with the Stanley Cups and the Olympic golds and the junior golds and all of that, we knew that they could be the game breakers, and they have the ability to dominate games, and the Jets have a few players that can dominate games as well. Blake Wheeler can dominate a game. Dustin Byfuglien can dominate a game at times, but you saw that in a period, and especially when you take a couple penalties. Mark Scheifele's penalty was clearly the TSN turning point, Drew, and the Ducks score on the power play, and that's as quick as it takes, Richie. You know, it's so underestimated, I think, how unpredictable the playoffs can be. The Jets were in control for a large portion of that game, you know, whatever you want to call it, a couple periods or 30 minutes, and it fell apart there, and I thought that early on in that game, Drew, the Jets were physical, they were controlling the pace, and we said that not taking penalties was going to be key, because even though the Ducks didn't have a very good power play during the regular season against the Jets this year, they showed that they have talented players like Getzlaf and Perry and Sammy Vatanen on the point. So it's a disappointing result, but I think the Jets overall had a pretty good game, and I think you can't read too much into it, because this is a 7-game series. The series isn't over. They're not in that room thinking that this series is over. I think you got to reevaluate what you did wrong. I think we'll get into it. I think some of the pairings weren't right, and I think the forwards as a whole left a little bit to be desired. I don't think there was enough sustained pressure at parts, especially in the third period. I didn't think the Jets generated enough offense, but I think they overall, I wasn't too disappointed in the way they played, but you got to be disappointed in the way they played, especially coming out of the third period shorthanded and losing a little bit of discipline. And that's going to happen, guys. There's more experience on the Ducks side. The Ducks have, I think it's around 580 playoff games, and the Jets have 300. So even though the Jets have guys like Ladd and Buff and others, Frolik, that have been there, you're going to see guys like Ryan Kesler try to get Mark Scheifele to take penalties, and that's something that they have to be careful about.
Yeah, you know, I thought they played an all right game. It wasn't, you know, I wouldn't be totally discouraged by their performance at all. I wouldn't be totally encouraged by their performance either. You know, good first half of the game, second period, as the Ducks came with that push, and then coming into that intermission, you thought the Jets might push back, and they didn't really. That was probably a bit of a concern, especially even having the opportunity on the power play right after the goal. That was the Perry goal that had to be reviewed. You would have thought a great opportunity to get back into it, especially after Adam Lowry answered the first goal right away. There's certainly no question that they can play with the Ducks. I think that was proven throughout the game. And as you said, as the series are all so close, most of the time the desperate team wins, which leads me to believe the Jets probably win tonight because they're more desperate. You need to get better performances from your top players. And, you know, we can keep talking about these third and fourth lines and the contributions and all that, you know, Lowry's goal and goals from depth lines. But the big boys need to be the big boys. Mm-hmm. It's the playoffs here. So you expect a better performance. Dustin Byfuglien didn't show up in Game 1. He's going to have to show up in Game 2.
Let me stop you right there, Richie. Yeah. That was probably what I was most surprised about, if you had to pinpoint one player's performance, is that I thought Dustin Byfuglien would have been, you know, geared up for this game like nobody's business. And for a lot of the game, he was sort of invisible.
Yeah, he wasn't that noticeable. Drew, I mean, yeah. Trouba had a great game. I thought it was best game probably in 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
That was very effective. Buffen wasn't that effective. But you tell me when those three guys went in the lineup together, Myers, Buffen, and Trouba, that they've all had good games at the same time. Hasn't really happened yet as far as I can recall. And it's a matter of getting in the flow of the game. And I think that's a factor. I mean, sure, that's an excuse to an extent, no doubt about that. But you want to see a better performance from him. But, you know, you have a first playoff game for a bunch of, for guys like Scheifele, and they'll get adjusted and they'll come back in a different form. The Jets have to be encouraged, I think, overall with their depth, I think, advantage, forward-wise, even defense-wise, frankly, to Anaheim. But the key of the series, and obviously we're going to get to it, is how do you shut down the big boys? And, you know, we could talk about it all we want. It's easy to talk about. If you don't think Paul Maurice and Charlie Haddie and Pascal Vincent were sitting up at night, probably till wee hours of the night, figuring out how do we stop these guys?
And they were doing that before the series started.
Yeah, before the series started. But now they have something to work with, sure. And they're going to have to see, okay, look at the film and see exactly what was happening. But frankly, if you look at the film, I would guess that there's not much that you know, to your point there, Drew, there's not much that they wouldn't have expected in terms of the style of play. You know, Getzlaff's going to sit up on the half boards in the power play. You know, Ezzie's got a hell of a wrist shot. And you know he's dangerous from there. You know Perry and Getzlaff go to the net. You know that they cause havoc. Maroon is a nice complement to them in the sense that he's big and strong. He's not fast, but he's big and strong. And those three are a load to handle. So, you know, as he spoke about it in taking penalties and putting a team on the power play, regardless of what their success rate was during the season. You're playing against the Jets 7 games, as we spoke about in the preview show. You get used to the penalty kill schemes. You get used to the personnel.
So why do you think, you know, the first period I thought was pretty even. You got, you know, there were chances at both ends. There were goals at both ends, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I thought that for the most part it was an evenly played period. But from the second period on, even with the Jets leading after the second period, I thought the Ducks had the better control of the game in its entirety. Why do you think the Jets sort of took that step back, Ezzie? Do you think it was a function of the Ducks were able to sort of step it up another level and the Jets maybe not prepared to do that given their lack of playoff experience? Or is it something just, you know, in the course of a game, there's ups and downs, and the Jets down lasted a little bit longer than the Ducks down did?
Well, Drew, the Ducks are a good team. I mean, they still are the best team in the Western Conference. So even though the Jets didn't play very well in that third period, you start off down a man, and it was a penalty that kind of changed the momentum of the game there, because even though the Jets mm-hmm. were only up a goal, they could have gone up by a couple of goals. Chris Thorburn had a good chance. If you remember, Matt Halaschuk threw the puck on net, and Chris Thorburn had a good chance, and Freddie Anderson made a good save there. But mm-hmm. I don't think that the Jets aren't prepared. I think Paul Maurice had these guys prepared. They came out, mm-hmm. and you know they had this game really in their possession after two periods. But I think that really if you really blink for a second, this team, and it's not just Getzlaff and Perry. The Ducks have really 4 really good lines, even with Nate Thompson out of the lineup, but 3 scoring lines for sure. You have guys like Thomas Fleischmann and Jiří Sekáč out, and a guy like Emerson Edom comes in and played pretty well. He's in his second year in the NHL, but I think that the Jets, they came out and they just didn't have the legs for whatever reason. I think it's tough to kind of explain. If the Jets hold on and win this game, we're not talking about that, right? And it's clearly we are talking about that because the Ducks scored 3 goals in the third period, but I think that power play really took the momentum out and they weren't really able to adjust to that and get their legs back, and they got away from what they've been doing successfully, and that's what the Jets do. It's not simple, and in the early part of the game they were out hitting the Ducks. They were taking away time and space. And back to Ryan Getzlaff and Corey Perry, these players are such elite players. We've talked about this time and time again. Earlier in the season, Getzlaff was playing like a Hart Trophy winner and probably fell off a little bit through the two-thirds mark of the season. Well, he's still one of the best players in the league, Drew.
Sure.
So these guys are going to get their points. I mean, you're not going to completely shut these guys out of an entire series. You might shut them out for 1 or 2 games in a series, but I think you take time and space away, and if Tyler Myers and Tobias Enstrom are matched up against them, you got to be more physical with these guys. Corey Perry's goal that he scored, the one that was reviewed, I think you give him time and he walks out and he walks in front of the net. You give him that space. You got to use the body on Corey Perry. You got to use the body on Ryan Getzlaff. It's easier said than done. Tyler Myers is 6'8". He's a big guy. You got to use the body on Corey Perry. You got the size advantage. And that goes for Mark Stewart and Jacob Trouba if they find themselves matched up against the Ducks' top line. So you got to take time and space away from these guys, but they are going to get their points. But you got to limit those chances that they get in front of the net. And it's tough, especially when you have the man advantage. These guys are skilled. They're big. But the Jets can do this. I mean, they have shown that they have the ability, whichever pair they throw out there. And I'd be curious to see, you know, Richie mentioned Dustin Byfuglien didn't have a very good game, paired up with Ben Chiarot. Be interested to see if they try to get him involved a little bit more and maybe match those guys against one of the top two lines of the Ducks to get him a little bit more involved. Because Buff had 3-plus minutes on the power play, but he just wasn't getting those quality chances that we're used to from him.
Well, he just wasn't the Dustin Byfuglien that we're used to seeing. I mean, he only played 20 minutes in the course of the game, which, I mean, I think it's not a problem per se, but you look at the Jets' right side defense, and you have three very good defensemen there. You got Byfuglien, and you got Trouba, and you have Myers. And, you know, some people would say, well, it's great, you can throw them all out there for 20 minutes a game, you know, 20 minutes each on the right side, and you know, they're going to be fresh for the series. I think those guys, maybe 20 minutes per game isn't enough for them to really get into the flow of it. Those guys are used to playing 25 minutes a game without much, you know, difficulty in doing that. So when you're down to 20 minutes a game, maybe it's a little bit, you know, it's harder for them to sort of get clued in to the game.
Tyler Myers averages 24 minutes, and Buff won't play a lot on shorthanded. He didn't play at all shorthanded in the first game, and I wouldn't expect that to change. That's where Tyler Myers picks up the minutes. But does Dustin Byfuglien need to play 25 minutes, say, Drew, to get more into the game? It's possible. But I still think he can be effective, and I think when Dustin Byfuglien is fresh, Richie, I think that's when he can be the most effective. So you're talking about not just on the power play, but in five-on-five situations. He's got to jump up into the rush. We've seen it using his size and speed. And I think that's what Paul Maurice is probably going to be telling him, because Richie mentioned when we were previewing this series, Jacob Trouba is a big part of this series. Mm-hmm. And you could say that he was the best defenseman on either team, jumping up into the rush. He was blocking shots, playing very, very well with Mark Stewart, who led all teams in hits with 8. So I think you got to get Buff going. He is the X factor. He is the guy. You know, you talk about Jacob Trouba, but I think especially offensively, the way Dustin Byfuglien's played this year, Richie, you got to get him going.
Well, the other thing, Drew, is I think ice time and lack thereof at times affects different players differently.
Sure.
So Jacob Trouba plays 19, just over 19 minutes in the game. I didn't think that affected him at all. But Dustin Byfuglien plays 20, and I think that might have affected him. I can't say there's a direct correlation there, but I think it's something to watch for. As he points out, the Tyler Myers, 24 minutes. I don't think his play was dictated as much by ice time. That seems to be the realm of what he's been playing, but
that's what he's averaged even with this season with Buffalo.
This series is an interesting series for Tyler Myers in the sense that it's going to be very physical, and Tyler Myers, to me, doesn't seem overly comfortable in a physical environment. Doesn't mean he can't stand there and take necessarily. He's big and strong, but he's not a guy who's going to engage physically too much, so you wonder how will that affect his play. But all this said, I mean, I thought the Jets had... They were able to sustain some pressure. They were able to certainly, I thought, outskate Anaheim. I thought the physical battle kind of ebbed with the game, kind of even, and then I thought Anaheim got a little more physical.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was something to watch out for. And then you have the goaltending. You want to see a little bit more from both those guys to kind of make a judgment. But there were really no surprises in the game is what I thought. Nothing really. We thought Kessler was lining up against Scheifele, and that's what happened. Mm-hmm. He's getting in his head. That's what happened. So, I mean, there's in reality, I didn't think anything there was overly surprising based upon our expectations, which to me would lead me to believe that the series will kind of take on the life that we expect and probably be a 6 or 7 game series, as I think we all thought. Remus had the Jets in 4, right?
Exactly. No, 4. Yeah, Remus, that's what we heard. As we heard 4. You mentioned Kessler, and he obviously got into the head of Scheifele, forcing Scheifele to take that undisciplined penalty. You know, I didn't think, aside from that, Kessler was especially noticeable.
He wasn't very noticeable.
Yeah, like he didn't have much in terms of scoring opportunities.
But hold on, Drew. How do you judge him? Do you judge him on scoring opportunities, or do you judge him on the output of the players that he plays against?
Well, that's a fine point. But, I mean, Drew Stafford did get a goal for the Jets there as well.
That's fair.
I mean, fair.
But did you think Scheifele was overly productive? And I guess that's a question to ask. The other thing is, I think you look at it as matchups. If you're able to keep that line down for the most part, the Jets-Scheifele line,
sure.
Anaheim will take their chances with that big guns against all three of the other lines combined, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's a fair point. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll look ahead to Game 2, see about any adjustments you'd like to see the Jets make. Much more to come. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, a proper fitting, custom-made mouth guard is a must-have piece piece of protective equipment. Don't be an Ezzy. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center, 204-487-2226, or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. So you look at Game 2 coming up in about 6 hours' time from now, a little bit more than 6 hours from now, 9:30 local time puck drop here in Winnipeg. And Matthew Perreault skated again, took the game day skate. He skated on a line with Little and Frolik because Andrew Ladd, of course, has not been taking any of the morning skates, you know, maintenance-wise. So okay. Ladd is going to play. Myers, who also missed the game day skate, is also going to play. But to me, if Perreault is skating in Ladd's spot and Ladd is going to play, that tells me that Matthew Perreault, while still officially a game-time decision, is unlikely to go today.
Well, it's all speculation right now, Drew.
Well, I mean, Paul Maurice has come out and said he's a game-time decision.
Right.
Perreault says he's feeling better. Well, but if they thought he was going to play, why would it, and he was going to take a regular shift during the game day skate, why wouldn't it be on the line that he's going to play with?
And that's fair.
That's a good point.
That's fair rationale. Because if you were speculating that he might play on the top line, it would be on the right side, not the left side.
That's right.
So that's a fair point.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think we need to take into account the mind games that go into the playoffs. There's an incentive for Maurice to say game time decision, to keep the Ducks on their toes in regards to planning for the game. Okay? So let's assume that no matter what, if he had a broken leg, they'd probably say it was a game time decision.
Sure.
Now, we really don't know how close he is. This ankle injury, is it a high ankle? Is it, like, what's the problem? Is it off the puck? Is it a twist? We don't know.
Well, Drew's checking out the x-rays right now, so.
Yeah, you know, and then so.
How do they get those anyways?
Yeah. Well, I can make a joke there, but I won't. So we really don't know, and they're playing mind games, but I think, Drew, your rationale is probably pretty sound in regards to where he's playing there and preparing for the game. The interesting part is in some instances in the National Hockey League, you'll have, you know, some extra day between travel for travel. I like that the fact that there isn't, just from a kind of a hockey watching perspective, and they play every other night. But that also plays a factor in terms of, you know, how much time there is between the game. And if game three, they think two more days here is something that'll get them better. Great. For example, if there was two days off after this game, maybe they would theoretically think it might be good to make him go. But because there's a quick turnaround, they might think that game three is more optimal circumstances to get him back in the lineup. But again, we don't know if he's going to be a game time decision throughout the entire series. We really don't. And nobody tells anything. And, you know, this is the playoffs. I have an issue with the regular season aspect of that. Oh, not admitting the injury in game 20. Like, these teams really care that much. In the playoffs, I understand the rationale behind it.
Yeah, Richie, you mentioned the mind games, but you also have to factor in that Matthew Perreault hasn't been taking regular shifts in practice. So this is only his first or second time taking shifts with the rest of the team.
Skating with the whole group.
Exactly. He's been coming onto the ice and practicing. So I think that would really lean towards, as Drew was saying, most likely he won't play tonight. But again, it's a toss-up. Paul Maurice has said that it's a game-time decision, Richie. There's no doubt that the Winnipeg Jets could use Matthew Perreault there on the third line, especially right now with the only line that's really going being the Stafford, Scheifele, and Wheeler line. The Andrew Ladd, Brian Little, Michael Frolik line is not producing right now.
Agreed.
And that's a problem. That was going in to the end of the regular season, Richie. No problem with the way Drew Stafford's playing. No problem with the way Mark Scheifele's playing or Blake Wheeler, who I thought was the best forward on the Jets. And you got to get the Ladd Little Frolik line going. We've seen that before. They're a fast line. They can get in on the forecheck. They can create offensive opportunities, and that line has to get going here. And you got to assume without Matthew Perreault, there's even going to be more emphasis on that line to start producing.
Well, how do you get Ladd Little Frolik going? Because it's not just, you know, yes, you know, game one that was poor. They haven't had any offensive success really since Little's return to the lineup. I'm not saying that's Little.
I would say they haven't really had a ton of success since Blake Wheeler moved over to the different line. I don't know exactly the time of that.
Sure.
But that would be my observation.
Well, and that's a fair observation that Blake Wheeler was the driving force behind it. But they still need to produce more offense than they have been producing, even without Blake Wheeler there. So, you know, is it time to maybe consider shuffling Ladd, Little, Frolik to get them going, to maybe get some fresh blood on that line?
Okay, I mean, that's an option, and the question is, what do you do?
What do I do? And I know this is going to be controversial, and I know it's probably not going to happen. Given the depth they have on the right side of the defense, I move Dustin Byfuglien to forward.
No.
No, I know. That's why I'm saying it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm not an NHL head coach, obviously. But they that's one of the reasons, obviously. The distinct lack of skill and lots of other reasons are more so. But they need to do... Ladd, Little, Frolik just trotting them out there game after game just hasn't, to me, accomplished anything. And this goes back to the regular season as well.
So what I would do, if that's something that's very concerning to you, Drew, and truth be told, I can see that point. The logical move to me would be to swap Frolik and Stepniak. You give it a different twist. I think Stepniak's got a nice shot. I don't think Frolik particularly has a great shot. You get the right-left side element on the angles and all that, and you get Frolik into a checking role with a guy like Lowry. He might. You know, it's funny because I thought Adam Lowry played a real nice game on Thursday. But it's always perspective, right? You know, your expectation for Lowry is different than your expectation for Little and Ladd. So, I mean, you know, he gets a goal. He played an amazing game. And don't get me wrong, he played a great game for what he had to do. But the skill players have more pressure on them, and rightfully so. So if you're thinking that you want to change it up a bit, to me the logical switch would be Stepniak for Frolik. Yes?
Yeah, and Adam Lowry has played with Frolik. If you remember when Brian Little was injured, Adam Lowry went up to the top line and played with Andrew Ladd and Michael Frolik. So it's not like he hasn't played with him before, Richie, in game situations. So look, they have to get some of their lines going here. And you mentioned Adam Lowry playing very well. He did play well. He got a nice goal on the pass from Jacob Trouba. They have to get this top line going. And the top line really, even though it might not be in minutes, the top line for me is Mark Scheifele, Blake Wheeler, Drew Stafford. So you got to get the first line going. And, you know, Drew, back to your point about putting Dustin Byfuglien on forward, I don't think it's ridiculous and it shouldn't be controversial. This is the playoffs. And I think, you know, when you have a situation where you're not getting balanced scoring and Dustin Byfuglien isn't playing his best, trying something new and adjusting to what the Anaheim Ducks are throwing at you is not a bad idea. So Dustin Byfuglien, whether it's for one game or for half of a game or whatever it is, I wouldn't say that that's a ridiculous idea. Look, the Jets have to win game two. They can't come back to MTS Center down two games. I think it's going to be tough for the Jets to win four of the last five games in the series. That's tough to do.
See, I think they win game three regardless, so I don't think it's an absolute must-win tonight, Ezzy. I see your point, though. I mean, most people probably share your opinion. I think they win game three here because of the emotion, and then game four is that kind of pivotal what it's going to be. I think the Jets can, you know, I think tonight's another tight game. I don't think there's anything here to be overly concerned about from a Jets fan perspective. But I do think your points are well taken in terms of creating offense and the top guys getting going. That's vital in terms of beating a team, you know, like Anaheim, who I think has been a little bit disrespected here. Certainly flawed team, no doubt about it. But, I mean, most people I saw actually had the Jets picked over Anaheim, and that may prove to be correct. And it's very possible that's proved to be correct. But I think that has served as motivation. If you don't think Bruce Boudreau, I would assume Bruce Boudreau went to one of his staff, and, you know, the staff of the team, he said, give me every single guy who picked the Jets over the Ducks. And I'm sure he put that right on the bulletin board. And the Jets can't control that, so I'm not saying anything here the Jets have done wrong. In fact, playing so well has, you know, that's the reason for it. Mm-hmm. But that's a motivating factor as well. And I think when you look at, you know, there's a lot of stats that lead them to be similar teams. And I think, you know, you watch them, I think they're similar teams. The one difference is, and this goes both ways, and Drew, this goes both ways in the sense that the Jets have been playing for their playoff lives for months. And that usually probably serves, that likely can serve teams well over the course of a season. The Ducks, and which is rare in this day and age, especially with all the races you saw, had, I think, at least a 10-point cushion for 2 to 3 months of the whole season. Mm-hmm. So if you think the incentive was there for them to turn it up at the same level as it was for the Jets over the final 3 months, I think you're mistaken. Now, that might prove to be an insignificant point at the end of the day, but I think it ought to be brought up.
And to further that, now that the playoffs have started, and everybody wants to see what's going to happen in game one of the series, right? Everybody wants to see how some of the Jets rookies have reacted. Mark Scheifele, Adam Lowry, and Jacob Trouba, even though they're not rookies, Adam Lowry's a rookie, but what I mean by that is they're rookies in the playoffs.
Yeah, sure.
Because Scheifele and Trouba are obviously in their second years. They did fine. I thought they did fine. Sure, Scheifele took the penalty. You're not going to beat Scheifele down because he took that penalty, because he played a pretty good game, and you're going to need him in this series.
Mm-hmm.
But to Richard's point, I think that the Ducks were sitting there, and they were in a really bad division, arguably the worst division, which
I think it was the worst division by far.
People didn't expect the LA Kings to miss the playoffs, at least Yeah. A lot of people didn't.
Even the teams that made the playoffs in the Pacific weren't great.
Exactly. So,
well, the teams that made the playoffs in the division were trading guys that, you know, traded Curtis Glencross at the deadline.
You were selling assets, not buying.
Teams in that division were beating up on the Oilers and the Coyotes, right? So the Anaheim Ducks, maybe they're the favorite slash underdog, meaning that even though they had more points, they're really the underdog because everyone's kind of picking the Jets to be this kind of Cinderella team, right? So I think that Richie's right. I think that does kind of work in their favor, but the Jets got to find a way here to really have a complete game, and they played very well down the stretch, and the only real hiccup was right after the All-Star game, and they lost the five games in a row, but when they're successful,
Your point is really, because you could point to the layoff being a factor here too.
Well, yeah, and do you lose momentum? Like, it depends how you measure losing momentum, right? And have they lost that momentum, or are they now a little bit insecure about their game? I don't think they are at all. I think the Winnipeg Jets have the ability to get back in the series with a win tonight, and I don't think that there's going to be any type of carryover letdown from the previous game. They got to put together a full 60-minute effort.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll continue talking about Jets Ducks. We'll look at the special teams question and much more. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
6 hours until game time between the Jets and the Ducks. You can hear it live on TSN 1290 at 9:30. p.m. start time. This segment of the show is brought to you by Frank Zappia and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtor of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com or at 204-772-2100.
Yeah, we're happy to have Zappia Realty on board here.
Absolutely.
You know, Richie, Remus is playing Springsteen early in the show. I think he's trying to butter up to you.
Yeah, I was a little bit puzzled by that.
Usually we play that towards the end of the show.
I mean, it's never a bad thing to play it, so yeah, I'm not going to get mad at him.
Yeah, why is it a problem? What's wrong? Nothing wrong with more Springsteen, right?
That's right, Remus. I agree with you there, 100%.
Good. Glad you guys agreed on that one. Let's talk about the special teams battle heading into Game 2 tonight. Obviously, we know that the Ducks were successful on the power play in Game 1, scoring 2 goals to the Jets, 0 on the power play. The Ducks' power play, again, continues to be not very good in the regular season, in the looking at the entire league, but very good when playing against the Winnipeg Jets. So let's look at the Jets' penalty killing first. What adjustments do they need to make? How do they try and neutralize the effect of that Ducks power play?
Well, the Ducks have a lot of talent, and it's pretty surprising that they were 28th or 27th in the league during the regular season with Ryan Getzlaff. And Sammy Vatanen actually led them in power play goals during the season, which was surprising. Getzlaff and Perry only combined for 7 power play goals. But I think the Jets can be a little bit more aggressive. And to me, that's the key when you're talking about Getzlaff and Perry. These guys, if you give them time and space, just like many elite players in the NHL, they're going to burn you. And the Winnipeg Jets, especially, when Michael Frolik took that penalty, Michael Frolik is one of their best penalty killers. And Jim Slater is in that category as being one of the best penalty killers. Blake Wheeler can be very dangerous. We saw with 4 or 5 shorthanded goals this year. So I think you got to be a little bit more aggressive, take away some of that time and space. And when you're talking about guys like Sammy Vatanen and Cam Fowler on the points, those guys are kind of the quarterbacks of the power play, along with Ryan Getzlaff, Richie. So I think you can be a little bit more aggressive. But I don't think that I'm as concerned about that element of the game. I think you stay out of the penalty box, Rich, and if you don't take penalties at times where you shouldn't be taking penalties, you don't have to worry about that. Sure, you're going to take 1 or 2 penalties a game. You hopefully don't take more than that. But for me, the Winnipeg Jets penalty kill has been very good most of the year. The special teams for the Winnipeg Jets are significantly improved from last year, and that includes the power play. Because the Jets had a bottom 5 power play even up until December, Drew. I remember we talked about it back in December, and it's been a lot better, and players like Blake Wheeler and Matthew Perreault and Dustin Byfuglien deserve a lot of the credit, Richie. But as far as the PK for the Jets, I think, again, you're not going to change anything at this point in the season, right?
No, don't change fundamentally what you're trying to do. I think strategically you have to change some things, as in that, teams like to take away the middle of the ice. Right, they want to make sure you go down the boards and all that. But I think with Anaheim, you're trying to. I mean, The dangerous part, and Getzlaf scores there, really, so it really demonstrates to you why he's so good, because he's such a great passer from the half boards, but he's got a wicked wrist shot. And he can get it off just quickly, too. You know, kind of like Ladd, usually just a button hook, boom, that thing's in the top corner. Like a beautiful goal he scored on Pavlik. So what you want to do is you want to force Getzlaf to not touch the puck. And, okay, you know, that sounds easy. But what I mean by that is if you're going to have Getzlaf with the puck, you want him to be on the right side, not the left side. You don't want to give him the option of being able to square up for a shot that easily on a no-look pass. You know, a no-look shot, excuse me. So I think what you want to do is you want to when you're forcing through the neutral zone, you want to force them to dump it in from left side to right. Because that happens there is the puck goes all the way around the boards and comes to the right side, and then the duck set up there, and maybe Getzlaf gets the puck there, and you saw a couple times he'd switch. But the idea is you want to make them waste time. You want to put them in an uncomfortable position. So through the neutral zone, I'd push them to the right side and make them put left side, excuse me, and make them put it all the way around the boards in the dumping. And what I would try to do is if Getzlaf gets the puck, I would be aggressive with him. He's really good, and he could use his size and such, but I'd probably have a bigger guy on that side, and I want to force him to get rid of the puck quickly. And sometimes that might hurt you, but he can pick you apart so easily when you play off of him that I don't think I really have a choice.
Sort of pick your poison situation.
Yeah, it is.
It's a good point by Richie. Another thing, too, is the Jets have to be better in the faceoff circle. They were 38% in the faceoff circle, and the Jets haven't been a very good faceoff team all year. Bottom 10th in the league. I believe they're 22nd during the regular season. The Ducks are at 9th, and the only guy that was above 50% is Jim Slater, and Jim Slater is one of the best faceoff guys in the league, usually around 58%. Mm-hmm. Ryan Kesler and Ryan Getzlaf. You usually see Getzlaf on the first power play, and then Getzlaf will come out there with Bolesky and Palmieri up front. They were dominating the Jets. Mark Scheifele had a lot of troubles in the faceoff dot, and Slater's usually on the second PK kill, so that's got to be better. And I agree with Richie here. That's why the Jets have been so successful on the PK with forwards like Little, Ladd, and Frolik, who usually go out there first if it's not Slater. And earlier in the season they had Gagliardi, but he's obviously not playing. But that's where the speed of the forwards, they got to make it difficult through the neutral zone. So those entries are bad, and Enstrom and Myers or whoever it is out there can get the puck out quickly. That's what you can't let them get set up, because the Ducks, again, that might have not been their forte. It was more of 5-on-5 where they scored their goals. But in the playoffs, it's a whole different animal, and the Jets have been struggling. So that's where those adjustments come in, Richie.
And you mentioned Scheifele's face-off. Well, I mean, you're going to go up against guys like Kesler, and these guys are he's a big-time face-off guy too, right? So that might be somewhere where you're going to give a little bit, and it's going to be tough. I mean, the Jets, Slater is, as you mentioned, your top face-off guy, is going to be out in the PK, and he's right. The face-offs are very important in terms of killing off those 20 to 25 seconds, and we'll make it easier on this team. Remember, the Ducks, they build on, again, it's all these in-series plays of momentum, in that you could have a bad power play all year and you have a good power play game one, you feel good about it, good power play game two. Who cares what you did for the 82 games? It doesn't matter. Really doesn't matter. So
clean slate.
Clean slate. And again, I've said so many times, but you're playing against the same guys all the time. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, sometimes it just works against the team.
Let's talk about the power play for the Jets then. I mean, we know that Matthew Perreault is a key linchpin in the Jets' success on the power play. But he's... wasn't in the lineup in game one. It's very much questionable if he's in the lineup in game two. So you can't just throw up your hands in the air and say, oh, woe is us, the power play is not going to be successful. How do they begin? What do they need to do better, in terms of making the power play, if not successful, at least more threatening than it was in game one?
I don't think really personnel-wise there's much more to do, to be honest. You look at the squad and the personnel that they have. I mean, Perreault is the key on that half wall on the right side, because he can pass. He's very creative, and he's got a really underrated wrist shot. Who else on the team has that same skill set from the left side?
Nobody.
So, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to create some guy? But you just got to keep... I don't think there's really too much to do, Drew. Conceivably, the one switch might be putting Myers up top and Buffon in front of the net.
That's what I was going to ask.
That's the one thing. And hey, I don't mind creativity. I would give it one more shot here in this game. And if it really doesn't work and Perreault doesn't come back for game three, then I think making a big-time switch after one game is a panic move. At the same time, after game two, when it's a seven-game series, Then you get into these situations where, okay, you're seeing some patterns of not working, and I realize still it's two games, but hey, it's a 7-game series, so it's yeah. you know, it doesn't really matter if it's only two games. So
you almost have to panic after game two if something doesn't work.
Yeah. And they're going to miss Matthew Perreault too as well. But the two guys who led the Jets all season in power play goals were Brian Little and Andrew Ladd. Those two players have to get going. And to me, you're going to have Bufflin out there with Enstrom, and Tyler Myers is going to get some opportunities, and Jacob Trouba on the back end. But those players have to start working better together as a unit. And Brian Little might be struggling a little bit with the aftermath of his injury there. And Andrew Ladd looks like he might not be at 100%. But as we know, this time of year, a lot of people are dealing with bumps and bruises. But to me, those players have got to get going, and you got to start getting more shots on net. I know it seems simple, but what did they have? 26 shots on net against the Ducks in game one. You got to start shooting the puck more, driving the net. Andrew Ladd's very effective in front of the net, tipping pucks. That's where he's made his living offensively. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they have to do. And you got to assume that Matthew Perreault's not going to be there. So you can't keep thinking, well, our power play is not going to work here. And you have Buff's big shot from the point. So they're fine with what they've got out there. Their power play is very improved. And to me, again, if you're talking about who's the most dangerous player for the Jets, if it's not Dustin Bufflin, it's Blake Wheeler. But still, Ladd and Little, these guys have talent. They got to get going, though. And I think that's, you know, it's stating the obvious here. It really is. But in game one, they weren't enough of a factor offensively.
You want to see them get more havoc in front of Frederik Andersen. I mean, Andersen obviously, he made some saves, but I didn't think he was very sharp. I thought there were rebounds available on shots that shouldn't necessarily lead to a rebound.
I'm not suggesting that Andrew Ladd runs him a la Chris Kreider, but this is the playoffs here. I mean, this is a war. You got to get into the face of the goaltender here, and Andrew Ladd has the ability to do that. Brian Little is more of a player that he's gonna set plays up, Richie, mm-hmm. to the side of the net. But yeah, absolutely, you got to make it difficult for Frederik Andersen. I think they can do a better job of that, absolutely.
See, I think you always can do a better job. You never have too much traffic in front of the net, Drew. But again, I think Frederik Andersen's a good netminder. I don't think people give him enough credit. And I'm not saying he's Dominic Hasek, but he's also...
I wasn't saying he was a sieve. I was just saying, I mean, I thought that there were rebounds there in game one that probably shouldn't have been there. And
I thought after the Thorburn save and then he just had the post there, I thought he got his game a little bit more as the game went on, to be honest. I don't think
was that a factor of him improving or the Jets not really getting much offensively going at that point?
I don't know. I really don't know. We'll see. You know, throughout the series, we're going to see. But I think he's a pretty solid netminder. He's not a dominant one, but he's pretty athletic. He's pretty big. He seemed to be picking up the puck pretty well, I thought, in game one. And in terms of Pavlik, we haven't really touched on Pavlik. I mean, you know, there were some tough goals that he had to face. That first Perry one, that puck bops right to Corey Perry. That mm-hmm. guy's going to score every time. And the second Perry goal, I mean, how many more saves do you want him to make?
Yeah.
The first one was tipped, I believe, right? That shot?
Well, the shot from the point, that was by Vatanen. It was deflected in off Ben Sherratt's skate, I believe.
There, and then the Gets left you on the short side. I mean, you could take issue with short side. I can see that one for sure. But do give Gets left credit in that. I mean, there's a few guys who
interesting
can take that
shot. The second Corey Perry goal, what turned out to be the game-winning goal, according to Carey Fraser, shouldn't have actually counted.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, next year, if there's a goal... I know. I don't disagree with you. I sort of had that impression. Okay. But next year, if there's the challenge flag, which apparently is going to exist, you know, if the Jets are
another reason why that's just ridiculous.
Of course it's ridiculous.
Let's throw a flag and did he initiate contact?
Next year, that's probably not a goal. That's all I'm saying, and I think it should be a goal.
You're fair, Andrew. I see what you are saying there, and that makes me think they're just going to slow down the game more.
I agree. I didn't have a problem with. I didn't really think it was goaltender interference, despite it probably by the letter of the law being. And next year it probably wouldn't count. And I think that's a little silly. But I'm just saying that, you know, if this was 12 months from now, that's probably not a goal.
So at the end of the day, it was reviewed. It was called a goal. The Ducks won. Move on.
Yeah.
So are we next year going to say, you know, what's the pull up the rule book and read me the description of hooking?
I'm
going to throw a challenge flag every play.
This is what the NHL has decided. I think it's ridiculous. I agree with you. I'm just, but you know,
challenge flags should be limited to pucks thrown over the glass and high sticks.
I agree.
That's fine.
Yeah. And maybe the most egregious goaltender interference plays, but that shouldn't.
That's still. I don't think even then.
I agree. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll look at the Flames and the Canucks series tied up at one, heading into Game 3 tomorrow night. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Ten minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Without further ado, we present Richie's Rant for the Week.
Well, Drew, I mean, this is just for the week.
For the hour, really.
So I, as he's liking this one, eh? So I'm preparing for the show and, watching a bit of that Toronto Raptors game. It was an exciting game. Mm-hmm. I could not believe, I looked at the schedule, I thought, well, there's two games at 2 o'clock in the NHL. Two games at 2 o'clock. I mean, it really makes sense to put two games on at the same time. Because, you know, I really enjoy watching two games at the exact same time. And then the next game's at 7 o'clock. Although, apparently, according to you, Drew, according to Larry Brooks, it's at 7:25. And the Jets play at 9:30. So, okay. NHL, the brains of the NHL are sitting in a room. And they think to themselves, all right, we got four games on Saturday. Some kind of spotty weather throughout the country. Both countries. Four games on Saturday. You know what we should, you know what we shouldn't do? We shouldn't start one game at 12, one game at 2:30, one game at 5, and one game at 7:30.
You mean exactly what the NBA is doing with their schedule today?
Exactly. Because you put four games, one after the other, so fans can watch all games and spend like a football day in front of the TV if they choose to do that. Instead, you're putting two games on at the same time, with a gap then of time after that game from 5:30 or so to 7:30 or so, and then a seven o'clock game really starting at 7:25, overlapping with your 9:30 game. Like, well, just idiotic.
There might have been a reason why they put two games at 2 o'clock. I'm not sure. I'm not sure why. I agree with you, Richie. I think it's nice to be able to. And they have been doing, before today, the first three nights, I think they've been doing a pretty good job of staggering games, and that's why you're going to see Game 3 in Winnipeg start at 8.
Yeah, but let me ask you that. So you're starting game 3 and 4 in Winnipeg start at local times 8 and 8:30. Yeah. So late start times
that's
here,
fine.
Central time. It's fine if you were, like, why are you staggering the games certain days but not other days?
Mm-hmm. That's the point.
And that's, you know, especially on the weekend where people, you could conceivably, some people could reserve, you know, a 12-hour block to just watch hockey back to back to back to back. It is a very bizarre.
Even if they don't, you lose the momentum of one game to the next.
Sure, they don't just fly from one to the
6
other.
6 o'clock, you're like, oh, there's nothing on. I'm going to go do something. I'll come back. Oh, I'll catch the second period of the game because you just don't get into the game because you're not watching the game. Who's making these decisions? I mean, we could talk about the rest of the broadcast stuff, but I'm going to pass on that today.
Yeah.
But, whoa, come on.
Okay, can we get to Calgary-Vancouver now?
We can get to Calgary-Vancouver, although I'm pretty sure that line brawl that ended the game is still going on in Vancouver. That was a pretty decent line brawl at the end of the game there. A couple guys had to try and take on Derek Englund.
I love it.
I know you do.
I absolutely love it. And I like how Remus, coming out of the break, played Nickelback there, which is the song for Monday Night Raw, because that really was some WWE type of stuff. I have no problem with that at the end of the game. Look, these are two teams that didn't make the playoffs last year, Drew. They're two teams that really, as we've said, are playing with house money as far as the expectations. One of these two teams is going to the second round and is going to play the winner of Winnipeg-Anaheim, which I think is going to be a tough series for either of these two teams. Not saying that they could win, but I would favor Winnipeg or Anaheim over either of these two teams. I think Winnipeg and Anaheim are both deeper. But yeah, as far as what happened at the end of the game there with Derek Englund fighting two guys, and it was actually, you know, a little surprising that Dan Hamhuis, a veteran defenseman, came in there as the third man in. We'll see if there's any supplementary discipline there. But I think, you know, earlier in the game, you saw Eddie Lack got a little bit upset because mm-hmm. the Calgary Flames were getting in his grill, and Eddie Lack was actually throwing a couple blockers to the head of one of those Vancouver Canucks defensemen. I forget who it was, but I have absolutely no problem with it. I mean, this is a war here. The series is tied 1-1. These two teams don't like each other. They're trying to win the series and get an advantage. The Calgary Flames, obviously, the game was over at that point, and they're trying to get into the heads going back to the Saddle Dome. So nobody got hurt. The fights weren't that bad. I mean, you saw Brad Richardson and Who was it on Calgary? It was
Matt Stajan.
Matt Stajan, who doesn't fight. And then you saw Dan Hamhuis come over with Derek England.
That's because England was beating up Dorsett pretty well.
It was Dorsett. Dorsett's tough, a tough though. Guy, too. Yeah, Dorsett's smaller, but England's big. And so, I mean, there's no problem with that. And, you know, Michael Furland, Manitoba boy, was getting into it there. So, you know, that's good old-fashioned playoff hockey.
You know, can the arguments certainly be made, at least I think to my mind, the argument can certainly be made that the Calgary Flames are quite fortunate to be down or to be tied 1-1 heading home for Game 3 because they've probably been outplayed, I think, for the majority of the two games with the exception of, you know, making the comeback and the late goal in Game 1.
I didn't catch that game last night, Drew, so I can't speak to that. I caught some of the first game.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about the Islanders-Washington game, which I watched last night. But, yeah, you know, I caught a different portion of that, so I can't necessarily speak to that, and I'll defer to Ezzy there. But even in the, you know, the scores aren't necessarily indicative always of who's carrying the play, and you have to factor in Calgary gets game one, you know, as much as you get. It goes back to desperation. Do they need to win the game? They're kind of a Cinderella story. They get first game in Vancouver. Vancouver suddenly needs to win the game. Those flows happen, and they're pretty predictable, and you're seeing it right now. You might as well do a score update right now in terms of the games that are on, because these teams need to win.
Sure. There's two games going on, as Richie's rant just demonstrated. In Tampa, the Lightning are kicking the Detroit Red Wings by a 4-0 margin after 40 minutes. So they're in the second intermission in Tampa with the Lightning up 4-0 on the Red Wings. And in St. Louis, late in the second period, the Blues are up 2-0 on the Minnesota Wild.
And before I let Ezzy expand on your question, Drew, two home teams are playing right now, having lost game one. That's exactly what happened last night.
Right, and of the three series that are tied 1-1. I don't think any of us are surprised. Right now, there's one series that has one team up 2-0, and it's the Montreal Canadiens over the Ottawa Senators. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised after the Jets-Ducks game if you had 7 of 8 series tied. I wouldn't. And we weren't surprised that the only series maybe that you would say was a given for the team to win is the New York Rangers over the Pittsburgh Penguins, and the Rangers only defeated them 2-1. I'd be surprised if the Pittsburgh Penguins are able to come back and win the series, but it's early. Point being that a lot of these teams are very close, not just in the standings, but the style of play. And there isn't any dominant teams in the NHL this year. I think, you know, look at Chicago. I think Chicago was a favorite before the playoffs started to maybe come out of the West. And now they have goaltending issues with Corey Crawford. And it looks like Scott Darling's going to start Game 3. So it's completely wide open. As far as the Vancouver Canucks and Calgary Flames go, the Sedins right now are the difference. The Sedins are the best players in this series, and the Vancouver Canucks shut down that top line of the Calgary Flames, Sean Monahan, Yuri Hudler, and Johnny Gaudreau. And I didn't think any of those players had a strong game last night. And, you know, Vancouver's got experience, guys. You're talking Dan Hamhuis, Kevin Bieksa. These guys have been through the playoff wars before. And these guys were strong yesterday. Didn't give the Flames a lot. The Flames had 3 shots in the first period. Only had 23 shots throughout the whole game. And, you know, a guy like Lance Boma's out. He got some key goals for the team this year.
Yep.
I think he had 15 goals. This team is going to struggle to score goals this year. And, you know, Jonas Hiller didn't have his best game. And he's been a strong goalie all year. So, I think I picked the Calgary Flames to win this series in 7. But I think it's going to come down right down to the wire. I think they're going to get a huge boost because they haven't had a playoff game there in Calgary in, 5 years or 6 years. So it's they're going to benefit from that momentum that the home crowd gives them there in Cowtown. But I think they haven't played their best hockey. I agree with you. Even in Game 1, even though Chris Russell got that winner and they won, I still think that there's a lot to be desired from the Calgary Flames. But one thing you know about a Bob Hartley coach team is these guys are going to work their buns off, and they're going to come out flying in Game 3.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we will look at the Habs and the Sens series. We'll talk about the PK Subban slash on Mark Stone as well. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
One hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg.
If the NHL was planning the game day coverage today, they'd have HNL and us on at the same time.
That would be radio gold. That would be absolute radio gold. Anyways, welcome back to the program. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, the official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey. Conveniently located at Cordon and Lanark in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli. Take it home or eat in their full-service restaurant. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
Our buddy Gabe Desjardins is listening to the show, and he's asking us if they're bringing back the $1,290 goal. Not sure if you guys know what that means, but...
Do you want to fill us in?
No, I'm asking you.
Oh, you're asking me. I don't know.
We're on $1,290, so maybe...
I assume it's something
anyways,
like that.
We appreciate him listening. I'm not sure he's going to have to tweet back at me with what that means. So.
Okay, well...
I can't answer you, Gabe.
Okay, fair enough. Anyways, we're back on the program talking about the Sens and the Habs series, with the Habs leading 2-0 after their overtime victory yesterday against Ottawa. I want to go back to game one first before we talk about last night's game. The slash from PK Subban on Mark Stone. Are you okay with there being no supplemental discipline on that play? Do you think that there, you know, much ado about a little, or do you, you know, how do you feel the NHL handled that circumstance?
Much ado about a little, probably, Drew. I didn't actually have an issue with the way they handled that. I mean, you know what, guys swinging their sticks like crazy there too. I mean, I've seen more vicious slashes. I thought the way they handled that, combined with the way they handled Dave Cameron's non-fine. Based upon kind of the season, really, and the motions that he was going through. I didn't have an issue. I thought they took a practical approach to it. It didn't look good for sure, and he got him right over the glove there. That's the area where you're going to be susceptible to injury, and which Stone was injured, though he played yesterday. But, you know, it's one of those things, if it happens again, I think you come down pretty hard on him because you see what he has done before with the two-hander. And apparently there were threats. But, you know, the thing about the threats and Brian Murray coming out and saying, nice to see Brian Murray out there and engaging in kind of the back and forth. Mm-hmm. And I like that. But when you look at in terms of the threats on the ice, I mean, if you counted how many threats were exchanged on the ice per game, I'm assuming it'd be quite a bit. You know, I'm assuming these guys say certain things, and I play in the National Hockey League. But if you were to ask, say, Shane Nattie or Trevor Kidd or some of those guys, it's probably quite a bit of threatening language used at all times. So I don't know if we have to read too much into that.
Well, it's funny. I think it was a tweet. I saw a tweet from Steve Simmons that said when Brian Murray was behind the bench, there was no coach who would use threatening language more against the opponents, quite like Brian Murray used to say. So, I mean, if he knows, I'm sure that Brian Murray's certainly been through the NHL battles. And
well,
knows
we know he has. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, he's not shy about using the media probably to stir up some trouble there. Ezzy, what about it? What did you think about the Subban slash on Stone?
Well, when you first see the slash, it doesn't look that bad, depending what angle, I guess, you were looking at it. And most of us were watching it from the same angle. And then you see another angle, and it looks a little bit worse, Richie. But, you know, PK Subban, you're slashing Mark Stone a little bit. To me, it was a little bit surprising that Stone had a bit of an injury. It wasn't enough of an injury because Mark Stone played in Game 2, mm-hmm. as did Max Pacioretty, who didn't play in Game 1. But to me, the slash was it was a pretty bad slash. I don't think it was anything comparable to a suspension-worthy slash. I think we've seen much worse slashes. And I think that everything surrounding the slash, the threatening, and, you know, Chris Neal... making public comments and all that. That's what you're expecting. Again, the playoffs are a war. Each series is a war. And I think that when you have a player of PK Subban's caliber, PK Subban was excellent last night. I thought he was the best player on either team last night. Scored a nice goal that was assisted by Devontae Smith-Pelly there. I thought he was really good. And I think PK Subban responded very well to everything that was surrounding, you know, the media hoopla and in Montreal with Mark Stone, whether or not he was going to play and should he be suspended, and are the Ottawa Senators going to go after him. And I thought he dealt with that very well. But I think a situation like that, you don't know, was it one of the parts of the glove where, you know, there's not enough padding? That's probably the situation that it was. But I don't think... PK Subban, put it this way, PK Subban is not a dirty player. PK Subban can play physically.
I think he's a little dirty, but I don't think it's a bad thing, is he?
Well, you can call him a little bit dirty. I think he plays the game the right way.
I like PK Subban as a player, and I think what he brings way more positives to the NHL than he does negatives. But his act sometimes wears a little thin on me. You know, after it's a pretty vicious two-hander. The puck's nowhere near the play. To me, it's fairly deliberate. And then he goes with, "What did I do?"
Yeah, I don't like that.
Bouncing around. You know, you see him in the runway behind the bench after he gets thrown out, and all upset. And how dare Stone come back on the ice and try and keep playing?
That's just because he just wants to get back into the game.
Well, then don't two-hand the guy on the wrist.
That's fair, Drew. I mean, don't be in the hall. Don't do all that. I can understand that. I do think, as he's talking about it before, I think that PK feeds...
You've agreed with me three times already, so I'm just going to leave for the rest of the show now.
I know. PK, he feeds off of that negative energy, though. Like, and if you watch some of that series so far, whenever the crowd's into it, it's like PK calls for the puck. It's like he's a... it's like he's in the post in basketball. He calls for the puck. They circle back, and he comes up the ice, tries to make a play. I mean, you get into it with him, it could be negative, it could be positive. He plays better. And as he's talking about him being a dominant player, he has been a dominant player. He looks very good. Remember last year, he got tired in the conference finals, but there were games against Boston. He was the best player on the ice by a mile. So, I think he's a clutch player. I don't think there's any question. He's their best player. Him and Carey Price are their two best guys. I know Pacioretty is vital to the team's chances, especially because they're a little bit top-heavy, but it's Subban, Price, and everybody else for me.
Going into Game 3, obviously, tomorrow back in Ottawa, Andrew Hammond struggled in Game 1, struggled in Game 2 again. Would you give any thought at all to going with Craig Anderson over Andrew Hammond at this point?
I think you always give a thought, Ezzy. I think you give it some thought. I don't think you do it, but I wouldn't make that decision in 5 minutes, put it that way.
You have to also consider, Richie, if you're not going to make that goaltending switch now, when do you make it? Senators have their backs up against the wall here. I mean, they're down 2-0 to a team that has had playoff success last year, and they know what to do when they have a team up against the wall. They swept the Tampa Bay Lightning in the first round last year. Sure, they didn't have Ben Bishop, but I think for the Ottawa Senators, and if you're Dave Cameron, you're thinking about it. Absolutely. Andrew Hammond has not looked good. PK Subban's goal aside, and Alex Galchenyuk had a really good game, but he's let in 7 goals now in 2 games, and they have really benefited from his goaltending and the fact that he wasn't allowing more than 2 goals a game. So I think if you're going to make that move, you don't make it in Game 4. You make it now, and I'm not suggesting that they make that move because you don't throw the goalie under the bus after 2 bad playoff games. But again, Andrew Hammond had no playoff experience going up against the goalie that's most likely going to win the Vezina and the Hart this year, Carey Price. Yeah. And you have Craig Anderson, who's been there and played in goal before in the playoffs. So if you're going to make that decision, you make it now. Because this series is quickly slipping away from the Ottawa Senators. The Ottawa Senators have made a nice run here. I picked the Montreal Canadiens to win the series because I think that they're a deeper team and they've got the advantage in goal. But I think, not saying they can't come back and win a couple games in the series, but they're not going to win any games, Richie, if Andrew Hammond plays like he did in Game 1 and 2.
Yeah, you bring up a lot of good points, Ezzy. Anderson is a veteran. Hammond got you here. And I think that goes a long way in that room. I would stick with Hammond. You've lost 2 games at home, but you've been on the road, but you've been in both those games.
Sure.
One
goal games each.
Yeah, one goal games, and you're going home, and I don't think you panic. That's the old saying, you don't panic till you lose at home. Of course, if it's Game 7, then there's no time to panic, but you know what I mean. Yeah. And so I would stick with him.
You would stick with him. That's another question I was going to ask for you. Do you think there's an element that the Canadians, sort of similar to the Ducks, maybe a little bit feeling a little disrespected entering in this series?
Fair point.
That's 4 now.
Yeah, I mean, because, because, Drew, the momentum is with the team, like the Jets and Ottawa coming in and playing, playing at a certain level to get in, as Montreal knew they were in. They were battling with Tampa kind of for that spot up there. But they were just battling with the team for positioning. We saw how much positioning really mattered to these teams when Calgary didn't play any guys for the home ice advantage. And Vancouver.
Back here on the last Saturday of the regular season.
There were a couple teams that didn't care about home ice advantage. I think the Washington Capitals or the Islanders, too. So if it meant that much, as compared to the playoffs itself, then that the teams would be dressing their guys. So, yeah, Drew, I think possibly. I'm not totally convinced yet, but obviously a good start for them.
quick update from the NHL's offices. Derek Englund, one of the instigator penalties that he received at the end of the game during the line brawl, that's been rescinded, so he won't be automatically suspended for Game 3 between the Flames and the Canucks tomorrow evening. He's Derek Englund, so I don't really think it makes a humongous difference one way or the other.
Well, hold on there. I would agree with you before the season that Derek Englund missing a game in Calgary wouldn't be a huge deal. No, Giordano, he's actually played pretty solid for them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's not a game breaker, but if you have to go to the well and pull somebody in for Game 3 at home with the emotion and not playing as much, that's not insignificant for Calgary.
It's not insignificant. That's fine, but he's certainly not. He's not Sam Bennett who missed a significant period of the game yesterday, and he's not Sean Monahan who's apparently been banged up or a little under the weather as well.
More so Monahan than Bennett, Drew. I mean,
yeah, of course.
England's
Bennett
big,
only has played three games in the NHL, right? Now.
England's a big guy as he's physical on that back end there, and you know Russell plays big for his size, and Weidman and Brody are more skill guys. So you need that size back there, and not that Vancouver's the biggest team or most physical team, but it certainly doesn't hurt at playoff time.
I love how it takes maybe at most two playoff games between, you know, for hate to actually develop between these teams. At most, it's two games. I mean, the Jets and the Ducks, you saw a little bit of, I'd say, dislike, especially towards the end of the game there with Wheeler and Stoner going after a little bit. They haven't got the hate on really yet, but almost in every other series. I mean, obviously, Montreal-Ottawa took about 5 minutes to get the hate on, and Calgary-Vancouver didn't take long either. That's really what the playoffs are all about.
I agree with that.
And that's what you're going to see, especially when a team is down 3 goals. You're going to see some of the emotions start to run wild. And you know with the series going back to Calgary that they want to send a message that we're not going to go down lightly. And that's why you see a player like Matt Stajan dropping the gloves there and Derek Englund protecting his teammates. And, you know, there's no reason to believe that this won't be a physical series for the rest of the way.
I do enjoy how the rules sort of just got thrown right out the window. I mean, Dan Hamhuis was clearly the third man in. Yesterday between England
I totally agree with that.
Dorsett. I mean, you can't. That's a textbook third man in.
I know.
And you're not going to hear much about it in terms of an additional suspension or anything, even though the rule of the law suggests he should be suspended for Game 3. I don't think any of us expect Dan Hamhuis to not be in the Canucks lineup.
Maybe you give him a fine just to set the pace for the rest of the
There's regular season rules, and then there's playoff rules, and playoff rules are have a much higher bar before you can actually get punished for anything. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll shift our focus to the Toronto Maple Leafs, and they've apparently fired everybody that ever worked for the organization this week. We'll talk about it next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Want to point out, Sean Wayans, of course, in town all this week. Started, I believe, Wednesday night at Rumors. He's got nine sold-out shows. Pardon me, 8 sold-out shows. So what they've done is they've added a 9th show. 4 o'clock on Sunday, an afternoon matinee. Check out Sean Wayans. That's the only show tickets are still available for. You can buy them online at rumorscomedyclub.com. Also, pleased to welcome Rumors aboard as the official sponsor of the Illegal Curve Overtime Pool.
Yes.
So any games that go to overtime during the playoffs, be sure to tweet at us, at Illegal Curve. Use hashtag ICOTPool, and you can win great prizes from our friends at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club.
You had Galchenyuk last night, right, Drew?
I did not have Galchenyuk last night, unfortunately. But that was not a very good goal that Andrew Hammond gave up in overtime there. Sort of a spinorama, backwards little flick on the net that Hammond certainly wants back. Let's talk about the Toronto Maple Leafs because they cleaned house. And it's no surprise that some people in the Leafs front office lost their jobs at the end of the regular season because you knew that that was going to happen. And no surprise that, you know, interim head coach Peter Horacek lost his job. And no real surprise that, you know, Dave Nonis lost his job, although there was these weird rumblings that maybe he was somehow going to survive that.
Mm-hmm.
But are you surprised at the degree to which the Maple Leafs have overhauled their organization and absolutely pretty much removed everybody from power with the exception of Brendan Shanahan?
No.
Should also say Mark Hunter and Kyle Dubas as well, keep their jobs. As
well, that's what I'm going to get, the angle I'm going on, because who's really in charge here?
We've asked that question.
Is Brendan Shanahan in charge? Is Kyle Dubas in charge? Is Mark Hunter in charge? And to that point, I mean, you fire everybody. I mean, the truth is the guys there deserve to be fired. I don't really have, I don't know the extent of some of the guys who were in the lower end of the organization, what the roles they really played, so I can't speak to that. Dave Nonis didn't do a good job there. He deserved to be fired. He's always had a difficult time because he's always followed Brian Burke everywhere. So how much of a factor was Brian Burke in the decisions that were made with Nonis? He's never kind of had that clean slate. The chance he almost had to do that in Vancouver, he was fired the summer that they had all the free agent money. Although he was fired and replaced by Mike Gillis, who made the right decision by bringing back the Sedins, which the rumor was that Nonis may not have, but that's pure speculation. My issue was Nonis was left there to take all the bullets this year, and they were going to fire him anyways. And so why didn't you just fire him at the beginning? I don't like that. I thought that was a little bit of an unclassy thing to do. Moving towards who they're bringing in next. Well, if I'm a general manager in the National Hockey League at current time, I work for another team, and maybe you're talking about compensation. That compensation element, Drew, kicks in when again? Do you remember?
I believe it was right at the draft, if I'm not mistaken, is when they were going to start with
right.
that.
So you have your little window now. Yeah. So if you're a GM of an organization and maybe you wanted to move to Toronto to be the GM, which is a possibility, would you want to leave a team with your structure in place to go work in Toronto under Shanahan and between, I will say, Hunter and Dubas? Even if you're a free agent general manager, would you want to do that? If you're Peter Chiarelli, for example, would you want to say, okay, I'm going to go work with Dubas and Hunter, so you already picked my staff,
mm-hmm.
and go take the job? It's kind of backwards. And if Dubas and Hunter have a say in who it is, you have to assume they're on the same page. And I don't think you can assume that. I mean, they've got different backgrounds and stuff. I mean, I don't know if you can assume that. And if they're picking a guy, they're picking a guy because he's buddies with them. They're picking a guy because they think they eventually can lead to success for themselves personally. I don't know. But it's a lot of fact. If you're going to clean house, like what I'm saying is, if you're going to clean house, you might as well clean house and let the guy at the top pick the rest, as opposed to clean house partially, leave the guys in the middle / higher up,
right,
and then bring in a guy to kind of sit on top of them, and then guys below them, and who's picking those staffs. What's the plan? And again, you know, you're going to be at ground, you're going to be at the bottom here, and you're going to go to the top. It's always easy to go to the bottom. It's harder to get back up. And of course, they would certainly, that process would be sped up if they're fortunate enough tonight to get the lottery, and God hopes so that they don't get Connor McDavid, because we couldn't deal with the media coverage of that.
No, the playoffs actually would just cease to exist, and it would just be the McDavid watch for the rest of the rest of the summer until the draft officially is made and he's selected. I think you make a good point. It is an awkward situation where Brendan Shanahan, he's got the title president, so you think he's got to be the head man, and then you're going to hire a general manager who would. But you already have these two assistant general managers. So what happens if, Shanahan likes your guy, or likes the guy he hires, which presumably he would, but what happens if Dubas doesn't agree with him, or Hunter doesn't agree with him? So, when it's almost a...
It points to one thing to me, Drew.
Chaos?
Well, no, it points to me that Brendan Shanahan would be the GM.
You think at the end of this search, he's going to name himself? I mean,
he says he doesn't want to be.
I know, but there's precedent in Toronto. Remember, when Ken Dryden came into the Leafs organization as president, he was going to conduct this great, far-reaching search and get a general manager, and it wasn't going to be Ken Dryden. And then at the end of the day, after this search really turned up nobody.
Assuming it was a long search.
That's very clever there, Richard. At the end of the search, he named himself sort of the quasi-general manager. And then they had John Ferguson Jr. in there. And again,
Mike Smith, too, wasn't he?
Mike Smith was there. And it was a ridiculous situation, as per usual, with the Leafs. So, it's a fair point. Like, what happens if the general manager comes in and within 3 months, he's getting along great with Shanahan, and Dubas and Hunter aren't getting along great with him? Are they then out? And maybe they're... Why do you keep certain? It's like it's like keeping a head coach for when a new general manager comes in.
It's like Boston. We'll talk to Jack Edwards about that later. But I just don't know, Drew. So it's an odd arrangement, but Shanahan has picked those guys and seems to be comfortable with those guys. So maybe he acts as a figurehead and those two guys run the team. Now, that kind of happened in Dallas with Les Jackson and Brett Hull.
Sure.
And it didn't work out too well. It doesn't mean that it couldn't work out well in the future, but it does mean that there is precedent for it not working out well if that were to be the form that it takes.
You know, I looked at it. I mean, I saw this question. It was posed on Twitter. It was posed by Al Strachan. And Al, of course, is a Hockey Hall of Fame writer, and he's a little bit of a rabble-rouser, a lot of a rabble-rouser. And he made the point, you know, why is Brendan Shanahan the guy to necessarily lead them through this entire rebuild and bring them back to the glory that they haven't seen in Toronto in going on, you know, 50 years at this point in time, practically? You know, and I'm not saying Brendan Shanahan isn't the guy, but... You know, there are some questionable decisions and some sort of weird ways they're going about it so far, I think.
Well, he's the president of the team right now, so he is the guy. And I think Kyle Dubas, the reason why he wasn't fired is because he was just hired. And the question is, as you mentioned, Richie, who's going to be the next GM? Are they going to go with someone who they already have? Is that Brendan Shanahan himself? Mm-hmm. Is that Kyle Dubas, who's the assistant GM? Or are they going to go outside of the organization with someone who is an heir apparent GM, like a Mike Fiuta, like a Paul Fenton, like a Sean Burke? Those are names that Michael Tracos mentioned in his post with the National Post.
Tracos going to join us in about 5 minutes' time.
And so it's a team that's rebuilding, and whether they get the first pick or the third pick or the fourth overall pick, this is a team that's going to get a high draft pick. And, you know, you got to hope that whoever is hired by the Toronto Maple Leafs is given quite a bit of power, and they aren't just a third assistant GM, which you're alluding to, Richard. So it's a situation where they have to pick the right guy, because this team is not going to be good for a few years at least. And with what Brendan Shanahan has done in his first year in power, really, could it have been any uglier? Firing Randy Carlyle and the team just completely tanking after Randy, after that, and bringing in Peter Horacek, who was, could you blame Paul McLean for not wanting to take that interim head coach job?
Mm-hmm.
Why would he take that job so he could be fired 3 months later? It's a complete mess. I don't think Brendan Shanahan, I love Brendan Shanahan as a player. I think he did a great job as the NHL Department of Player Safety. Brendan Shanahan had 0 years of management experience when he took that job. No experience at all.
The Leafs spoke to him at the NHL, and the NHL said, from what I heard, I don't know who reported this, or I just heard it, from what I heard, it was, you have to make a decision if you're hiring him or not right away, because it's a conflict of interest dealing with the National Hockey League. And apparently they maybe had sped up their decision-making process and brought him on board maybe quicker than they had hoped, because they were left with pick him or else.
Look at these guys like Sean Burke, Drew, and Paul Fenton. They've been in management roles for a while now before we expect them to potentially be GMs.
Mm-hmm.
And again, who am I to tell Brendan Shanahan how to run a hockey team? We're just calling it like we see it. And this year, it's been a complete mess. This has maybe been, for a franchise that went through the Harold Ballard years, this is probably the lowest this franchise has ever been. And this isn't someone who's piling on Toronto right now. I mean, this team is a mess. And this GM has to be called, because they now have to already focus their attention on the draft. They fired the scouting staff, so now you're bringing in new scouts who are going to have to make their decisions now with the draft coming up in late June. So you got to make these decisions. Who's going to be the GM? Mm-hmm. You have to make these decisions in the next couple weeks here.
It is sort of a weird time to fire your entire scouting staff, I would think, because, you know, you've been paying them all year to do their scouting.
That's fair.
The draft is coming up in, you know, a few months. Where are all these free agent scouts that you're hiring now? You know,
that's where I assume the dollars come to play.
Yeah, but I mean, if you've got a contract with, you know, any other team in the NHL and you're a scout right now, you're probably not able to move to the Toronto Maple Leafs, I would presume, until after the draft. I mean, you go back and read Gare Joyce's book.
Yep.
You know, most of the scouts are generally on 1 year contracts. Most of the, you know, the professional scouts and the amateur scouts, and there's a ton of them who go to all the small towns and all the small arenas throughout Canada and the US and really Europe as well. They're usually on 1 year contracts, but those contracts, you know, they don't become available, you know, in the weeks before the draft. So the timing's a little bit odd in terms of, like, how are you finding out who you're going to pick in the fifth round? And sure, those are usually long shot picks, but...
Yeah, no, hey, Drew, it still helps to have seen the players. I can see that point. It'll be interesting to ask Michael Tracos about that.
in terms of how they're going to go about that, and if they have some, you know, they have something in place. You've heard of certain guys being let go, or chief scouts, remember, maybe right before the draft. But wasn't it Montreal, if I recall correctly, as Montreal had hired, might even been brought on Rick Dudley or somebody, I forget who it was, and they were not allowed to sit at the table until after the draft because of the...
when they brought in Dudley as the assistant general manager, because wasn't he with Florida before at that point? That,
and they had been with them before the draft, and they didn't want him to be able to share that information until after.
Yeah.
So something like that. I mean, you know, there are ways to get around it, but...
Timing's a little weird, though, is all, but...
Well, again, why, you know, you're going to hire the boss, quote-unquote, with two bother bosses already there. So... You know, unless it's going to be somebody that Mark Hunter has a real... And Kyle Dubas hasn't been around long enough to have the same relationships with a guy like Mark Hunter does.
Sure. Unless it's Dale Hunter.
Well, yeah. But Dale Hunter's, you know, maybe he would coach the team.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't be the GM.
He's happy over there in London as the head coach of the London Knights.
Well, Drew, and does this not just point more to the fact that Brendan Shanahan is showing that he has absolute control there, right? So Steve Casper, who's the director of pro scouting... Director of Player Development Jim Hughes, these guys have been relieved, and now Brendan Shanahan is going to be able to make all of his decisions about who he wants to hire.
Shanahan hasn't even been that. Like, I don't think he even lives in Toronto.
No, he still lives in New York, is my understanding, and then he travels back and forth.
And Dave Nonis didn't live in Toronto either.
Did Nonis live where?
I think Connecticut.
That sounds familiar. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, that doesn't bother me. I don't think the general manager necessarily needs to live full time in the city that he's the general.
I kind of think that he does have to live
in
the city.
Here.
Okay,
yeah,
that's fine. I mean,
I don't think the other guy staff members.
I don't think I don't think the owner necessarily has to live in the city, but the general manager of a team, the main guy, I think he should live.
There's
in the
historical
city.
Precedent of, I mean, but it's going way back to like Red Auerbach when he was the GM of the Boston Celtics. Actually, lived in Washington for all those years. That's, again, going back probably about 40 years.
And Mike Fuda for the Kings lives in Toronto, so that was why they had some ties to him possibly being the Toronto GM. Having said
he's
that...
He's the Kings assistant GM right
Yeah,
now.
He's the assistant GM. He can be anywhere. It's the GM needs to be in live in the city that he's working. JP Ricciardi didn't live in Toronto either, if you want to get... A lot of these... Nobody wants to live in Toronto.
Maybe. we'll ask Michael Tracos about that. Let's head to break when we come back. More on the Leafs and their front office situation. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN 1290.ca.